stickers. Most never got them. Many months later, during the general election, Brooklyn resisted dispatching resources to Michigan and Wisconsin, despite on-the-ground pleas from labor unions that Trump was gaining there. Ed Rendell, the cocksure former Pennsylvania governor, who has butt-dialed me more than once, urged Brooklyn to spend more to reach suburban and rural parts of his state. But he was always told no. 3 weeks before the election, Brooklyn stopped polling altogether in Pennsylvania, Florida, and other states. By one estimate, the campaign ended with as much as $20 million in unused funds, which could have paid for a pile of yard signs and polling and targeted ads in the Rust Belt, but instead partly went to Jill Stein's recount efforts in Wisconsin. After Braden's death, I pleaded with the campaign on behalf of all the travelers. We worry it will soon be untenable and unsafe to travel between events. With no commitment on the bus and Hillary content to have us trailing her at 80 miles per hour like paparazzi, I landed in the Quad Cities, bracing to spend the final month before the caucuses driving on Iowa's frozen farm roads. I asked for the biggest, baddest motherfucking truck they had. The black Toyota 4Runner had stained upholstery and no power anything, but looked as if it could have been driven by a dude in a monster truck show, crushing all my months of Ford Focuses in its wake. The woman at the Avis counter apologized that the layer of grime from off-roading couldn't be washed off because of the freezing temperatures. I examined the truck, dangling its keys around my index finger. It had a "don't fuck with me" silver grill, half a foot lift on the enormous all-season tires, and, by some stroke of rental car fate, Texas plates. Chapter 23, Meeting Our Waterloo. Des Moines, January 23rd, 2016. And what rough bureau, its hour come at last, slouches toward Des Moines to be born. John, the news assistant, emailed the politics team. The New York Times had arrived in Des Moines. Our temporary politics bureau was up and running in the Waterloo conference room, a windowless space with loud carpet, beige walls, and a low-hanging popcorn ceiling on the third floor of the Des Moines Marriott near a covered walkway that led to a Quiznos and the parking garage. I'd parked Beast, my name for the 4Runner, and walked inside to see the sign that displayed the daily forecast, high 32, low 17, a stock image of a martini resting on a bar, and "We've been expecting you, New York Times newsroom." In the 2 years, 6 months, and 24 days I'd been on the beat, I'd had the freedom to travel almost entirely without adult supervision. I once went to Montana just to try to smooth things over with one of the guys during a dinner of artisanal beer and cow testicles. I'd been on so many trips to Little Rock that I'd turned one of the doormen at the Capitol Hotel into a source. "Pile of Clinton old-timers here, something's up," he'd whisper at check-in. I knew where to find homemade tamales in Vegas and a surf simulation workout in St. Louis. I'd racked up so many Avis miles that when Bobby and I rented a compact car to drive from Miami to Key West, they welcomed us on a red carpet and presented me with the keys to a convertible BMW Z8 Roadster. The travel came at a cost. I was lonely. I missed my work wife, Michael Barbaro, and his daily commentary on my wardrobe. I would just maybe wrap the scarf this way. It was like a tree falling in the forest. Was it even a cute outfit if Michael didn't see it? New York Magazine had deemed Michael, with his round-framed glasses, salt-and-pepper curls, and a goatee so groomed that its mustache and slender chin line practically formed a Timesian T split up the center of his cylindrical face, a member of the Times' gay mafia of political reporters. He had a Yale degree, an Upper West Side co-op apartment, and he took wide, confident strides around the newsroom, all of which camouflaged that he had as big a chip on his shoulder as the rest of us. When I first met Michael, I only saw his posh exterior, but by the time we occupied adjacent cubicles in the politics pod, gossiping and cracking "that's what she said" jokes all day over our shared partition, I knew him to be the son of a New Haven firefighter who had scrapped to get his foot in the door. In addition to fashion critiques, Michael became an invaluable resource as I tried to keep up with inner office gossip while on the road. I did everything I could to both travel and deliver stories. I wanted to think that at heart I was still a foreign correspondent, whether it was a coffee shop in Cedar Rapids or a factory in Shenzhen. But in the era of live streaming and Twitter and a candidate who hardly acknowledged us and almost never broke script, my editors often didn't see the point. I was about to take my seat on a JetBlue flight back to New York from Orlando when one editor said, "I worry you'll be in the air and we need this for the front." I ran upstream, pushed past passengers as they loaded their carry-ons overhead, and demanded that the flight attendant let me off the plane before takeoff. "You know you can't reboard," she said. "Yeah, got it," I said. I then sat on the floor of the Orlando airport near a power outlet to write the story while the industrial carpet cleaners passed by. I ate a stale Starbucks bistro box and checked into the Hampton Inn. The next morning, I got the first flight back to New York and bought the paper with my A1 byline. Adding to my urge to travel, I knew that even as Hillary ignored me, it pissed her off when I skipped her events. After I'd taken a couple weeks off the trail, I ran into Huma at the annual Blue Jamboree fundraiser in North Charleston, South Carolina. I said hello as she stood under the trees dripping with Spanish moss. "Oh, Amy," she said behind her dark cat-eye sunglasses, "are you still covering this campaign?" Just as my stint in Tokyo had, my months traveling the country started to create a schism between my new life on the road and my old one back in New York. I began to feel more at home among strangers in the TSA pre-line than with Midtown office workers shouting out their coffee orders. On days when Politico scooped me or Twitter directed its ire my way, in other words, most days, I took comfort in knowing that no one lined up at the Cinnabon at O'Hare cared what was happening in my little world. I'd find myself at a rare Sunday brunch back in New York cringing at the conversations I'd overhear about summer shares on Fire Island and gallery openings and seeing Hamilton for the second time with the new cast, things I would have talked about too in my old life. But that was before I spent most of my days talking to people in the middle of the country who couldn't afford health care or lost their jobs when the factory closed or took out a second mortgage to pay their kids' college tuition. Everything back in New York started to seem so petty. And each time my editors summoned me back to New York after a couple days of making calls and watching the election unfold via Twitter and CNN, I would plead to go back out. This election isn't happening in my cubicle. Pat Healy, who in addition to Ann Kornblum, was the only person who understood what it was like to have your personal life and psychological well-being upended by Hillary and her cadre of adoring men, had also been in Des Moines for weeks. For years, OG, echoed by his minions, had told me Pat wouldn't hesitate to take me out. The opposite happened. Pat's arrival on the politics team made me feel as though the target on my back had faded, or at least been covered up under so many layers of fleece and down that I didn't walk around with it like a scarlet A anymore. Pat was the most fair-minded reporter I knew. If the guys had tried to take him out, too, then maybe David Carr had been right, and it wasn't me. Pat and I both arrived in Iowa several weeks before the caucuses. He missed his boyfriend Ray, and I missed Bobby. We made a pact to comfort each other with daily over-the-top, mildly sexual compliments. "You look so hot in that down vest," he said when I climbed into the booth across from him after 3 hours of sleep and reached for the bottomless coffee. Pat wore sweatpants and a white undershirt. He is objectively hunky, with fervid blue eyes, a head of black waves, and a few days of stubble. "Have you been working out? Your chest looks ripped," I said, and then we'd giggle and carbo-load on Linder's bagels and cheese Danish at the buffet at the Rock River Grill and Tavern inside the Marriott because we never knew when our next meal would come. Then, in the final week before the caucuses, the person I'd been in New York and the person I was becoming on the road, two sides of myself that no longer seemed to fit, collided. Carolyn, a half a dozen editors, a handful of support staff, and at least 20 political reporters all descended on Des Moines. They seemed so out of context in Iowa, so blatantly not of the place, like when my parents visited from Texas and I took them for avocado toast on the Lower East Side. "Hey, welcome to Iowa. Wow, everyone is here," I said, as I burst into the Waterloo to greet my colleagues. I quickly realized that Midwestern friendly wasn't quite the vibe. A couple of people mumbled, "Hi," without looking up from their screens. A social media editor gnawed on her fingernails. The web producer next to me quivered his right leg so wildly that I felt the folding table vibrate. Descriptions of our proposed stories were splayed on a whiteboard, and I watched Carolyn stand up and with the flick of her wrist kill several slugs. By then, the 2016 story was moving so fast that the features and analysis pieces we'd proposed, or that editors had ordered up, could, by the end of the day's news cycle, already become stale. My heart ached as I watched Union Jeb, followed by Bernie Kids and Dems Fracture, swept from the annals of history with a single eraser swoop. The Waterloo had the silent, harried feel of the final minutes of the SAT had the test been administered in a Siberian labor camp. "What the fuck?" I mouthed to a colleague who only shook his head and dropped his eyes back down to his keyboard. "Mommy and Daddy aren't speaking right now," he g-chatted me, which was what we said when Carolyn and her top deputy stewed after a heated debate. The arrival of the Times in Des Moines signified more than my own reigning in. The race had finally become real. For the first time, people would vote, or caucus, whatever that meant, and the story we'd spent the past couple of years preparing to cover would take on its own wild, unpredictable life. This led to our descent from steady and manageable low-grade hysteria to such high-grade hysteria that when Hillary said we needed a more open conversation about mental health, my first thought went to the Times politics team. My editors implemented a 7:45 a.m. ET daily conference call, during which, in a hungover haze, we'd all try to one-up each other with our definitive hot takes. Cruz has sealed up the evangelicals, and Hillary's gonna hit Bernie on foreign policy today, and Trump's debate scam won't work. Carolyn, aside from a couple of grunts and, okay, who's next, hardly ever reacted. That made us all even more hungry. I hadn't seen Bobby in weeks. In Japan, we'd always made time to talk, but on the trail, I hardly had time to call to say goodnight. He'd booked a flight to come visit that weekend. He'd heard so much about Iowa and wanted to see it for himself in all its flat, bland American glory. I adored that Bobby wanted to experience life on the trail, as he called it. There would have been no trail for me without him encouraging me to stick with it, and he somehow didn't hate the road for keeping us apart. He met up with me whenever he could. With Bobby there, even the simplest trail activity, heating up hot pockets in the lobby of a Hilton Garden Inn in Manchester, became an adventure. "Life on the trail, babes," he'd say, pulling down the floral duvet and spreading a picnic of junk food out on the sheets of one of the room's double beds. In 2008, I had even snuck Bobby into a primary debate. He held my reporter's notebook and told the organizers in his thickest Irish accent that he was with Horse and Hound magazine. He'd already planned to drive to Iowa City and visit a science center in Des Moines so that I could work. But sensing Carolyn's stress level, I worried she and my other editors would see Bobby in the hallways at the Marriott and frown on me trying to squeeze in a personal life a week before the caucuses. I told him to cancel. The line went silent. I sensed his tolerance for my travels, my selfishness, my always putting Hillary and my job before everything else, wearing thin. "It's too late to get a refund," he said. "I haven't seen you in almost a month." "I know, and I'm dying to see you, but I just can't right now. I'll pay you back for the flight," I said. An empty promise, since our money all came from the same place. We hung up, further apart than we'd been in years. I was pretty focused and stoic about another week without Bobby until my Glow app sent me the super helpful pastel purple alert, "Your fertile window is closing." This led to my sobbing to Maggie Haberman over a Chardonnay in the hotel lobby. She looked up from Twitter over her glasses. "Okay, you need to take that app off your phone immediately," Mag said. Chapter 24, The Girls on the Bus. Iowa, 2016. To our traveling press corps, Happy New Year, the email read. For your safety and convenience, we will be providing a bus that will begin in Davenport and transport press throughout the swing. I had an excuse not to work from the Waterloo. We'd finally gotten our press bus, a glorious maroon signature premium people carrier with TVs over every third row and boxed lunches and bottled water piled up on the front couple of rows and power outlets under all our seats. For the travelers, the arrival of the bus, parked in all her packed journalism splendor on the frozen Mississippi Valley fairgrounds in Davenport, signified more than an end to speeding tickets and Avis points. We'd finally moved into our very own communal home, like a loft apartment on MTV's Real World, but with wheels. In the outside world, most of us wouldn't have chosen to spend our time together, and certainly not that much time together. But in our shared caravan, we were the travelers. The bus marked the beginning of us becoming a rowdy, high-strung family, forever bound by our bizarre lifestyles, unhealthy diets, and constant search for a power outlet. The nine or so of us on that first bus trip wanted to mark the moment. We stood on our seats and squatted in the aisle to fit into a group photo. "Say, I'm with her," a young campaign staffer said. "Can you just take the picture?" one of the wires said. Like all candidate reporters, I'd devoured Timothy Krause and Hunter S. Thompson and Richard Ben Kramer and David Foster Wallace's Up Simba plus glossary, romanticizing the campaign bus entirely out of proportion. I imagined great men, the heavies, as Krause called the top rung on the hierarchy of the traveling press, Johnny Apple, NYT, David Broder, WashPost, and Bob Novak, Chicago Sun-Times, driving public opinion in between drinking sessions. Their prose had the power to sway primaries and make other great men into presidents, or tear them down until they were also-rans confined to a historical footnote, see Muskie, Edmund. The job had a poetic renegade feel. Men left their wives and families and their comfortable homes in the suburbs to sleep in a different hotel every night, all in the service of democracy and dick-swinging. Add to the political clout, free-flowing booze, and summer camp camaraderie between reporters, who spent our days together in buses and nights at the hotel bar on an expense account, and well, it was hard to believe that anyone got paid to have that much fun. That's not to say I felt like much of a journalist on the campaign trail. Writing an entire story on Deadline on your lap from a swerving press van and a motorcade while trying not to spill what's left of a 4-hour-old venti cold brew does require a certain skill set, but it never felt quite like journalism. Even in 72, the reporters assigned to travel everywhere a candidate went didn't exhibit much intrepidness. The travelers knew the candidate and the campaign better than anyone, but we also had to grudgingly accept that we existed mostly for protective purposes, in case something happened. The 08 campaign had hardly been a media love fest. The travelers had been so pissed at Hillary for ignoring us at one point that when she made a 1-minute, 28-second visit to the press bus offering bagels and coffee, "I didn't want you to feel deprived," no one partook. Reporters actually turned down food. That was how bad it was. Hillary had to apologize after one of the 08 guys nearly blew a gasket on us before the press bus even pulled out from the Marriott. "You know, he's not the person I would have put in charge," she said. Another 08 guy told the bus driver to speed up when he spotted ABC News' Kate Snow sprinting through the parking lot of a Hy-Vee in Des Moines after she'd lingered too long at a meet-and-greet with Bill, Hillary, and Magic Johnson. The campaign once put the traveling press file in a men's locker room, where I wrote my story while sitting between Tina Brown, the glamorous former Vanity Fair editor, and a urinal. These accommodations should in no way be taken as a comment on the quality of our media coverage, the 08 guys said. But at least back then, the traveling press secretary actually traveled with the press. This didn't seem like a radical concept until 2016, when on most days, not a single person authorized to speak for the campaign ever traveled with the press. Proximity was power in 2016. They preferred instead to ride alongside Hillary in the motorcade or on her private chartered plane. On one swing, when there was no room on the charter between Iowa City and Ottumwa, Brown loafers sat on the plane's turned-down toilet seat for the half-hour flight rather than ride in our putrid press quarters. On a typical day, we'd spend 18 hours on the bus only to set eyes on Hillary from the back of a packed gymnasium or as a flash of blonde disappearing behind a van door held open by a bulky Secret Service agent. I think it was Cheryl Mills who said that by the time women and minorities reached the presidency, the role has been vastly diminished. Well, call it a slap from the patriarchy or a stroke of bad luck, but by the time women reporters dominated Hillary's press corps, Twitter and live streaming and a female candidate who had zero interest in having a relationship with the press vastly diminished the campaign bus's place in the media ecosystem. My colleagues could cover a speech or a press conference on the rare occasion those happened while watching the live stream from New York, where they'd have Wi-Fi and power and wouldn't have to worry about waiting in line at a porta potty on Deadline or some fresh-faced campaign staffer yelling, "Loading!" right when you're crafting the perfect nut graph. The traveling press had become the province of what one prickly print reporter on his way to a buyout called the human tripods. The young network embeds who'd never covered a campaign before and who had to capture everything the candidate did on video. As long as the tripods delivered a live stream, the print reporters could do our jobs and the ecosystem worked. The Times and the Post and the AP and Politico still broke news and provided TV talking heads with something to gab about. But in our little leper colony on wheels, the masters of Snapchat and Vine and Twitter and Periscope had become the new heavies. He practically goes around with a t-shirt saying, "I work for the New York Times. I'm number one." That was how one Politico described the Times' Johnny Apple to Krauss during the 72 campaign. I approached our inaugural bus outing, a two-day swing to Davenport, Cedar Rapids, Des Moines, Osage, Sioux City, and Council Bluffs, ready to project a similar haughtiness. I even wore a synthetic wool hat that I'd bought at the company holiday sale with a stretched The New York Times in white embroidery across my forehead and that almost everyone made relentless fun of. I work for the Times. I'm number one. My sense of superiority lasted about 2 hours and 35 minutes. That's when I found myself somewhere on I-80, perched over the back of my seat, pleading with the embeds to let me watch their video feed of Hillary's town hall. Because Hillary preferred to fly to her events, and really, who wouldn't, the bus-bound travelers couldn't make it to the Cedar Rapids and Osage stops. Our only option was to live stream Hillary's Iowa events from the press bus in Iowa. Then, through the muffled intercom, the driver, whose name tag read Chuck, West Des Moines, Iowa, apologized. All I heard was, "So sorry, folks, got a generator break." The power and the Wi-Fi went out. We could live without Krispy Kreme donut holes and Chips Ahoy snack packs. We could even hold our noses over the toilet that had several counties back run out of antibacterial hand foam. But the prospect of losing Wi-Fi as Hillary carried on without us in Cedar Rapids pushed the travelers over the edge. How would we explain to our editors that we'd allowed ourselves to be sequestered hundreds of miles from the candidate we're supposed to babysit? I imagined something terrible happening, a terrorist attack or an assassination attempt. My editors would pull me off the trail forever. I could hear the scorn. "You had one fucking job!" That's when the world's most influential print publications, the Times, the Post, the Journal, Politico, the AP, Bloomberg, and Reuters, banded together and did the one thing we still felt empowered to do. We whined. "She could have been shot, yeah, or dropped dead of a heart attack. Seriously, guys, what if something happened to her and we weren't there? The bus fucking sucks. I hate the bus. Sorry, Chuck. How much longer?" The days continued like that. January 23rd, Davenport to Clinton, Clinton to Davenport. January 24th, Davenport to Marion, Marion to North Liberty, North Liberty to West Des Moines, West Des Moines to Davenport. January 25th, Des Moines to Waukee, Waukee to Knoxville, Knoxville to Oskaloosa, Oskaloosa to Des Moines. Until the campaign had become one endless bus ride through frozen cornfields. My whole body and my journalism atrophied on the bus. On most days, I'd make at least a dozen calls to sources, but on the bus, I hardly made any phone calls or talked to anyone outside my fellow travelers. I no longer had the energy to yell at my editors when Pat Healy or Jonathan Martin got to write the daily A1 stories. I lost my will to protest when editors only wanted me to send color and quotes that would be melded or not into the Roundup Franken-story, what we called the editor-assembled daily news stories with multiple bylines and several contributor lines at the bottom. I didn't even complain when the travelers had to convene in the lobby of the Marriott at 7 a.m. only to drive to the Jewish Federation of Greater Des Moines and sit on our bus outside as Hillary answered questions about Israel. The campaign said the space was too tight to accommodate her largely Semitic traveling press corps. During the event, Hillary had a mild coughing attack, or at least it looked as though she'd had a mild coughing attack, from the live feed that I watched on my phone while standing in the parking lot puffing on an e-cigarette. I hadn't smoked since high school, but at 37, it seemed like as good a time as any to develop a nicotine addiction. The Subway sandwich situation had become so dire that I gave some poor freelancer a lecture about bus etiquette after he'd grabbed two turkey sandwiches, leaving me to eat the shredded lettuce, pickles, and tomatoes off a footlong that I'm pretty sure had fallen on the floor. We started to hoard food. I once filled a hefty garbage bag with hard-boiled eggs, hummus packs, and fruit trays from an Oban pan in Indianola and slung it over my shoulder hobo style as we trooped on and off the bus. Irina, the Vogue writer, who was Russian, watched me do this and asked if I'd ever been an orphan in the Soviet Union. We reverted to tweens. The bus almost abandoned us in Vinton, population 5,257. After we couldn't pull ourselves away from the Fast and the Furious arcade game at the roller skating rink where Hillary spoke. She declared, "The entire country, indeed the entire world, is watching to see what happens right here in Benton County. The entire world, except the members of her traveling press, who are in the adjacent room locked in a heated game of Miss Pac-Man." We established cliques, banished newcomers to the landfill. We started our periods at the same time and sang Justin Bieber's Love Yourself on a loop. While our counterparts on the Bernie bus exuded the unexpected cockiness of covering a budding insurgency, the Hillary press mimicked the morose march of our assigned campaign. Jason Horwitz, who'd also been in Hillary's 2008 traveling press when he was with the New York Observer and who had his own scare trying to get to a John Edwards rally, "Horwitz taxi hits Turkey, both lose," the Observer headline read, was now with the Times and assigned to the Bernie bus. Jason knew my obsession with Midnight Cowboy and started calling me Rico, the character who dies in the film's final scene, his head resting on the window of the back seat of a bus. "Rico? Rico? Hey, Rico," Jason texted me, imitating John Voight's Joe Buck as he tried to shake Dustin Hoffman awake. Bernie packed an auditorium in Decorah, telling the 2,300 people, "Today the inevitable candidate doesn't look quite so inevitable." Hillary, meanwhile, spoke to 450 in the city's Hotel Winnesheek Ballroom, where the crowd of mostly the over-65 set wore red T-shirts with the fighting words, "Does your candidate have a plan for Social Security?" In Sioux City, Bernie filled the Orpheum Theater. Days earlier, when Hillary, paranoid about comparisons to Bernie's crowd sizes, went to Sioux City, she held a Fighting for Us town hall at the Orpheum Theater. Not in the theater auditorium itself, but in its ornate foyer. Supporters squeezed onto the stairs and hung over gold-leafed balconies festooned with American flags. Afterward, campaign aides bragged that a crowd stretched around the block, at least a couple hundred people, who wanted to see Hillary but couldn't fit inside. Shit, I thought, if only there'd been a larger venue, like a theater nearby. Hillary's Iowa town halls became so frequent and intimate that they started to take on the familiar, if laborious, feel of catching up with an old girlfriend who cites GDP statistics over brunch. On a Saturday afternoon in Clinton in eastern Iowa, motto, "So many things to do with a river view," Hillary cracked herself up when she told the small crowd at Eagle Heights Elementary, "You didn't have to name it Clinton, I would have come anyway." Her brow grew deliberate. "I gotta tell you, I did a little research, and Clinton County is named for DeWitt Clinton, the sixth governor of New York, and what is so interesting, because I admire DeWitt Clinton, he was the person who said, 'We're going to build a canal from the Hudson River to Lake Erie, all the way across New York to open up the West to commerce.'" It didn't matter to Hillary that by this point the crowd had started to fidget and look down at their phones. Or that most of the press, sensing a prolonged history lesson, had stood up from our rows of seats at the back of the auditorium and moved to a nearby room set up with bottled water and bags of chips. "He started when he was mayor of New York City, just pushing, pushing, pushing as hard as he could, and finally, on the 4th of July, 1817, they broke ground. It took 8 years. He was elected governor. He worked really hard. Then he ran into some political headwinds. I know a little about that." Some laughs. "He was voted out and then he came back. I know a little about that too." Some more laughs. "And then in 1825, after those 8 years, the Erie Canal was opened up." Of course Hillary was DeWitt Clinton. She had the perseverance and the political headwinds and the $275 billion infrastructure plan. What did Bernie have? She had so much fun telling the story that I figured we'd driven the 3 hours from Des Moines to Clinton that morning only so she could riff on DeWitt, no relation. I think it's pretty interesting that the folks who settled here named this part of Iowa for DeWitt Clinton, she said, in conclusion. They understood that he was a leader who set big goals and then he worked. He did the politics. I wasn't entirely sure how DeWitt's big goals squared with Hillary's other campaign promise at the time, which was that she wouldn't overpromise. I would rather underpromise and overdeliver, she told 460 people at the Five Flags Center in Dubuque. The underpromise line made Brooklyn cringe. It didn't take a room full of pollsters to know that American voters preferred to elect charismatic men who wildly overpromise. But Hillary didn't want to be like them. She was a realist, or as I called it, a radical incrementalist. She tried to tell voters in 08 that Obama couldn't deliver on the hope and change he was selling. Now I could stand up here and say, let's just get everybody together, let's get unified, the sky will open up, the light will come down, celestial choirs will be singing, and everyone will know we should do the right thing and the world will be perfect, she'd told a crowd in Providence, Rhode Island during her primary fight against Obama. 8 years later, Hillary privately blamed the country's anger in no small part on Obama's inability to deliver. So for a while, before her aides pried the under-promise line off her lips, Hillary would tell Iowans, I don't want to over-promise. We don't need any more of that. You had to give it to Hillary for being back in Iowa at all. It had to be agonizing to get up every day and try to win over the voters who had handed her a mortifying third-place finish in 2008. For years, pollsters warned her, they just don't like you in Iowa. But had she skipped the caucuses, we all would have written stories calling her entitled, an imperial candidate running scared from the liberal base. She wasn't going to let that happen. Hillary tried out comedic shticks and did impersonations that I almost never saw her do outside Iowa. She'd get to the part of her stump speech about how she planned to improve the Affordable Care Act, including how she'd lower the cost of prescription drugs, a winning issue with her base of aging boomers. Part of her plan, she explained, would stop pharmaceutical companies from receiving tax credits for advertising on TV. At this point, Hillary would swirl her arms and segue into reciting in florid detail what sounded like a Cialis ad. You know the ads, they have people walking through fields of wildflowers, walking on beaches, they have the name of the drug, which you know is unpronounceable, and then in a low voice, and Hillary would soften her voice, pull the microphone close to her lips, and say in a deep, guttural pitch that always made the travelers look up from our laptops and chuckle, if you take this drug, your nose will fall off. On the rope line, when a French journalist shouted over Katy Perry's roar and thrust his camera Hillary's way, knocking me in the head a couple times, Madame Secretary, for French TV, for French TV. Hillary waved and put on a faux French accent. It's so good to see you. Bonjour, bonjour, French TV, bonjour. After these town halls, Hillary stuck around to shake hands and dole out compliments. I love that outfit, she said, tugging at a woman's knitted scarf. This is pretty. Is that attached? It's really pretty. She made small talk, asked what kind of music she liked. Hillary swayed a little and shouted over a Kelly Clarkson song. You know what? I'm kind of a 60s person, to be honest. Old school. Yeah, old school. That brings back a lot of good memories. Shouts of Madam President always made Hillary beam. Doesn't that sound good, she'd say. Let's make it happen. Hillary practically dove at a man in a gray leisure suit who carried a copy of Hard Choices under his arm. She signed, Best Wishes, Hillary, and as she handed it back with a come-hither wink, said, It's a complicated world, isn't it? After speaking in a bowling alley in Adele, Hillary was so swarmed with a group of teachers, I hope you get an excused absence today, that she grabbed my phone right out of my hand to pose for a selfie. Huma whispered in Hillary's ear, that's Amy's, and Hillary handed it back so fast it looked as if she'd suffered electric shock. Is that yours? Oh no, she said. She would dispense policy prescriptions, pausing amid the crush of selfies to ask Iowans about their COLA, cost of living adjustments on Social Security, and whether they'd signed up for an income contingency repayment plan. I once saw Hillary criticize Bernie's college plan, I'm not going to take care of rich people, to a 13-year-old whom she then referred to HillaryClinton.com to read the details of her new college compact. That's what it's called, okay, Hillary said, crouching down to eye level with the preteen. He stared blankly. Want a selfie? She asked. January 29th, Des Moines to Dubuque, Dubuque to Quad Cities. January 30th, Ames to Carroll, Carroll to Cedar Rapids. January 31st, Council Bluffs to Sioux City, Sioux City to Des Moines. On late-night rides, NPR's Tamara Keith would call her toddler to read him The Very Hungry Caterpillar. Everyone thought this was adorable, but all I heard is Tamara repeated in her radio voice, "In the light of the moon, a little egg lay on a leaf," was, "Your fertile window is closing." I'd turn up my music to block it out. On long drives, our conversations started to revolve entirely around Hillary's Iowa idiosyncrasies. In 08, Hillary talked about the nurse from Waterloo so regularly that the traveling press had lengthy hypothetical conversations about this romanticized nurse in Waterloo, always stretching out the loo for several syllables the way Hillary did. 8 years later, an enormous 3D printer had become the new nurse from Waterloo. Hillary discovered the printer, the largest in North America, by accident. It was December, and she was touring Cedar Valley Tech Works in Waterloo. She watched entranced as the contraption spit out a 2-foot-tall sand and resin, 3-dimensional version of her H campaign logo made entirely of discarded corn cobs. "Oh, come on, come on!" The printer might as well have produced a handful of fully formed Hillary superdelegates. The 3D printer was made in Germany, but it quickly became Hillary's favorite symbol of American exceptionalism. It was 3D printer this and 3D printer that, 5 or 6 times a day, usually followed by her lengthy proposal to create advanced manufacturing jobs in the Midwest. "When I went to Cedar Valley Tech Works, I saw the biggest 3D printing machine in all of North America," she told a crowd in Waterloo. "It's amazing." In Dubuque, Hillary called the 3D printer a job magnet for the Midwest. In Urbandale, she called the $1.5 million gadget thrilling, a big job multiplier, and a business growth strategy. Hillary vowed to be the president who helps Iowa make this kind of machinery, 3D printers, in America. And keeping with her promise to only make modest promises, she even vowed to cut the ribbon on the first 3D printer production plant. After the first couple of days, Hillary had relayed the story so many times that she started to mix up the details. "I was at the Black Hawk Community College. They bought the biggest 3D printer in North America because they're thinking about the future," she said in Des Moines, Dubuque, and half a dozen other cities. Black Hawk College was in Moline, Illinois, and Hillary had never visited. But even, or especially with the muddled details, the giant 3D printer became emblematic of Hillary's campaign style. She could be so pedantic in expressing her sincere optimism for the American worker that she either bored audiences or went over their heads entirely. On the bus, the travelers were simultaneously tired of hearing about the 3D printer and at a complete loss for anything better to talk about. "Hillary won't stop talking about that fucking 3D printer. It'd be funny if she started placing in whatever state she's campaigning in at the moment. I was just at Henderson County Community College, where they had the world's largest 3D printer." That would redeem this whole humiliating ordeal of a campaign. Chapter 25. You Will Look Happy. Thing about Iowa, no one could call it. Richard Ben Kramer, What It Takes, The Way to the White House. Des Moines to Manchester, Caucus Night, 2016. By noon on Tuesday, it was still too close to call Iowa. We landed in Manchester after 3 a.m., dropped our luggage at the Marriott Courtyard near the airport, and had to be in Nashua 6 hours later for a Fighting for Us rally. Bill Clinton summed up the campaign's mood after Iowa when he took the stage in Nashua and opened with this stirring line, "Well, we're here and we're awake." We were there and we were awake. 24 hours earlier, on my last day in Des Moines, I'd spent the afternoon at the Marriott working from my Formica desk on 2 versions of my caucus night story. I had a lyrical 800 words pre-written that assumed Hillary won. Quotes from friends gushed that the winning results showed Hillary had expelled the ghost of 2008. She was a new and improved candidate with a well-oiled campaign. I assured Brooklyn the story wouldn't run until the results had been tallied, so aides told me, embargoed, on the record, that Hillary's Iowa win proved Bernie had no path and that Hillary would handily defeat the Republican nominee, Jeb or Rubio, obviously. Mrs. Clinton became the first woman to win the Iowa caucuses. I was writing the precursor to the November FWP story, the story all these years were leading up to. By noon, the campaign assured me, not for attribution, that their internal polling put Hillary on track to win the caucuses by 5 or 6 points outside the margin of error. So I put minimal effort into pre-writing the Hillary loses Iowa again version. I cobbled out a quick hypothetical lead. Des Moines, Iowa. Hillary Clinton confronted an unexpected and devastating loss in the Iowa caucuses on Monday night, thrusting her campaign into strategic upheaval and raising questions about whether her candidacy can address an angry and restless electorate. After the caucus results trickled in, I sat there typing and deleting, typing and deleting, typing and deleting. My print deadlines came and went. In 5 hours, I'd maybe written 50 words of usable B matter. It was almost midnight on the East Coast when an editor broke the news that my story would be banished to the two words a Times reporter never wants to hear, web only. Despite our talk about the web and digital first, the 6 most beautiful words in the English language remained, they want it for the front. I should have pre-written a Hillary said she won, but basically tied, and we're still not sure, but let's just get New Hampshire over with and move on to the primary states with black and brown people version. But my sources had been so certain. The polling data put her outside the margin of error. The campaign had even less idea about what to say. Hillary arrived at her victory rally at Drake University a couple of hours late wearing red. I stood on a folding chair in the back of the room and marveled at how good Hillary, hell, the whole family, was at smothering any honest emotional reaction. With Bill and Chelsea standing on stage behind her, Hillary drew into some deep reserve of fakery and willed herself into looking happy, as if trying hard enough would make it so. I remembered the advice Huma had given to a sobbing Anthony Weiner staffer after the Carlos Danger sexting scandal enveloped her husband's mayoral bid. "I assume the photographers are still outside, so you will look happy," Huma said. With a plastered-on grin, Hillary pointed at the crowd, equal parts Iowans, Washington insiders, and New York donors, and a pile of baby boomers who came up in caravans from Arkansas. I saw Hillary smooth her suit jacket. She ran her palms down the sides of her thighs, the kind of fidgety gesture she hardly ever made on stage. "I love it! Wow, what a night! An unbelievable night," she said, letting the word unbelievable hang there. "You will look happy." I stand here tonight breathing a big sigh of relief. Thank you, Iowa. Rachel Platten's fight song came on, ending Hillary's 6-minute and 45-second speech. "Loading," a rosy-cheeked campaign staffer yelled over the campaign's newest girl power pop anthem. We rolled up our power cords and drudged through the parking lot to the bus with our open laptops cradled in our arms. The travelers looked aghast. What just happened? That didn't feel like a victory rally." "No, no, it did not," I said. We were sitting on the bus in the parking lot when my phone exploded with texts and emails. Democrats saw the virtual tie as an omen and wanted campaign manager Robbie Mook layered. Nobody said he should have been fired. That would have led to too many negative headlines. Nothing drove news traffic like Clinton infighting. The Democrats, who'd come up during the McGovern campaign in particular, worried the 36-year-old campaign manager's approach, all math and no poetry, needed to be replaced by some old-fashioned fire. The younger operatives would point out that Nixon defeated McGovern in a landslide. People proposed Maggie Williams, who had been Hillary's chief of staff in the White House and was one of the only people who could tell Hillary no. Maggie had been dragged into easing Clinton melodrama for years, including reluctantly taking over in 2008 from then-campaign manager Patty Solis Doyle, who was fired after Iowa. To avoid negative headlines, Robbie could even keep his title and his corner office and his standing desk and his mafia of obedient bros who'd followed him from McAuliffe's Virginia governor's race. But Maggie had been there, done that. She was content to offer counsel from her perch at Harvard. By 2016, I'd forgotten most of the katakana alphabet that I'd attempted to learn in Japan, but I did speak fluent political cliché. I turned again and again to the most overused words of the Democratic primary, organization and enthusiasm. I asked Bernie and Hillary people which was more important. They all said, you need both. But like a bratty teenager playing a drinking game, I demanded an answer. You must choose. Most people settled, not for attribution, on enthusiasm. Organization don't mean shit if people aren't excited about the candidate, a veteran Texas Democrat said. Robbie was an organization man. Bill Clinton, the ultimate enthusiasm guy. What's a dad an organization for if voters don't like Hillary? Bill would say to anyone who would listen. They need to see the person I know. About a week before the caucuses, at the end of an especially newsless bus swing, Demi Lovato performed Confident on campus at the University of Iowa in Iowa City, the epicenter of the Feel the Burn movement. She introduced Hillary, saying there wasn't a woman more confident than Hillary Clinton, telling the crowd the truth that one of Hillary's more endearing qualities is that despite her successes, she is a heaping pile of insecurities, wouldn't have played well. Hillary came on stage to a sea of Snapchatting co-eds. She thanked Demi and spent a total of 3.5 minutes reminding the couple thousand students in the audience to caucus. I waded into the crowd afterward. I didn't meet a single student who said they were supporting Hillary. I'm just here for Demi, a rail-thin sophomore named Tyler told me. So why was he wearing an H sticker? He looked down at his plaid flannel shirt as if surprised to see it stuck there against his almost inverted chest. I don't know, they gave it to me, but Demi's cool, she's got my vote. We heard the same responses at Katy Perry concerts and Lena Dunham house parties. I'm here for Lena, said Heather, a 33-year-old from Cedar Rapids. I don't want to vote for someone for president of the United States because I love Lena Dunham. Pete D'Alessandro, Bernie's top man in Iowa, could hardly drum up an endorsement from anyone other than Susan Sarandon and Mark Ruffalo. But when I asked him about enthusiasm versus organization, he compared these star-studded Hillary events to a story from the 1968 campaign. Pete had slithery hair and a goatee and none of the polish of the political class who worked for Hillary. But he spoke about the race with a Zen certitude that I never heard from the Clinton camp. A Jedi master in Dickies and shabby black fleece. In 68, Eugene McCarthy's campaign held a barbecue that attracted hundreds of voters lined up with McCarthy for President signs as far as the eye could see. The scene led Bobby Kennedy's campaign to think McCarthy had a lock on the primary. Kennedy ended up defeating him badly. Turned out, Pete said, they just came for the ribs. I eventually settled on a nut graph that said the uncertain outcome had dealt a jolting psychological blow to the Clinton campaign, leaving volunteers, donors, and aides confused throughout the night and then crestfallen. Our newspapers and networks paid $1,700 per person for us to take the 3-hour press charter flight from Des Moines to Manchester. Hired gun guy strong-armed our bosses to call Iowa in Hillary's favor while swearing to us that she'd obviously won. I didn't think I could experience a middle-of-the-night charter more fraught than the flight to New Hampshire after Hillary's third-place finish in 2008, when the campaign, after blowing $50 million and nearly half a year there, collectively poo-pooed the state. The worst thing would be to overcount Iowa and its importance, Mark Penn told us on the Let's Get the Fuck Out of Iowa caucus night charter to New Hampshire 8 years earlier. Iowa's so small, it's like a mayor's race in a medium-sized city, added one of the 08 guys. At least back then, the campaign spin was quotable. The shit sandwich the 16 team tried to feed us was virtually useless. No matter how hard he pushed and how slick his delivery, something about Hillary's hired gun guy telling us, "We believe strongly that we won tonight," didn't exude triumph. The press climbed over the seats and poured into the aisle. We steadied ourselves on each other's shoulders and hoisted each other up until our muddy snow boots stood on the leather business class bucket seats. As photographers and cameramen affixed their lenses above our heads, the print reporters squatted down on the ground, our slingshots loaded. "Can you move your hair?" a photographer yelled at me in a request that would become almost as frequent as, "What's the Wi-Fi password?" We were ready for our $1,700 gaggle. It went something like this. Truncated audio. Hired gun guy. "We've heard a lot in the last few weeks about enthusiasm, but it turns out there's a heck of a lot of enthusiasm for a progressive who gets things done. traveler number one. Is your internal polling off? It seems like this came as a surprise. It had you up. Hired gun. What do you mean? Traveler number one. A tie isn't what you were expecting over the past few days. Jin. We believe we won. Traveler number two. Why didn't you declare victory in that speech? Hired gun guy and Jin. We did. Traveler number three. You guys had a ground operation, i.e. organization, that was second to none. What does it say about the candidate and her message? Was there a problem there? Hired gun. We believe we won. And so on for 9 minutes and 31 seconds until Jin announced, the rest of the plane will be off the record. I heard from my editors at the Times who were stuck in the Waterloo conference room because of a looming blizzard. They needed an official campaign comment for my story before we took off. I made the very bad decision to yell at the guys. Are you bringing in any new advisors to the campaign, layering over Robbie? I asked this not once, not twice, but three times. I said we're now off the record, Jin shot back as she walked toward the staff seats at the front of the plane. Then Brown Loafers, who, of the current crop of guys, took things the most personally, unleashed all his pent-up rage about the Times and my coverage into one drop-dead look and three irascible words. Are you serious? I was always misreading the ebbs and flows of the press scrum. After the Guernica press conference, I almost never asked about Hillary's emails, figuring the TV reporters who were jumping out of their chairs with, "What about your emails?" questions had that covered. I'd scream softballs. What kind of ice cream did you order? When my editors needed answers about some shady Clinton Foundation donor. Or I'd ask a question about foreign policy. Do the reports of ISIS holding Yazidi women as sex slaves change your thoughts on intervention? Over the mooing of dairy cows at the Iowa State Fair. In 2008, Hillary used to tell me I was asking the wrong questions. Well, Amy, that's not what you should be asking. And then proceeded to respond to the questions she wanted to answer. God, I wish you weren't always asking the wrong questions, Ann Cornblatt, the Washington Post reporter, would say as the scrum disassembled. I botched even the most straightforward questions. In South Dakota in 2008, I raised my hand to ask Obama a question about his faith outreach advisor, Joshua Dubois, and whether he could win over evangelicals. But I'd accidentally said Jeremiah Wright. Senator, Jeremiah Wright told me. Jeremiah Wright, Obama said, taken aback. I mean, Joshua? You mean Joshua Dubois. At this point, the entire press corps was laughing so hard that I don't think Obama heard me when I muttered, right. Late that night, on the Change We Can Believe In plane, Obama came back to the press quarters. I hadn't met him yet and introduced myself. I know you, he said with a giggle. You're the one who asked me about Jeremiah Wright. But asking about Robbie's potential ouster in front of the entire traveling press corps before the caucuses had been officially called or any alcohol served had possibly been worse. Hacked emails later showed that Brown Loafers had called me an idiot to one of Hillary's closest friends, Capricia Marshall, after she'd asked about my reporting on Robbie. I would have thought he'd called me worse. I did get a nice note from the Trump campaign saying that Mr. Trump didn't think I was an idiot. We must have been somewhere over Ohio. A couple of photographers and sound guys were on their third lukewarm can of Coors Light. I chased Brown Loafers down the aisle to try to explain myself and hopefully smooth things over. Would you rather I don't ask you about rumors I'm hearing? He kept walking. I tried again. We should really talk about this. He didn't turn his head. He walked straight to the back of the plane and plopped down with the tripods, whispering to them over red wine in plastic cups and reminding me, without saying a word, of my own minusculitude. That flight would draw a line in the sand between me and the guys that a couple of days later in New Hampshire would morph into an insurmountable moat. Chapter 26. He deprived her of a compliment. Manchester, February 2016. Psychological blow? Are you in my head, Amy? No, really. Tell me, are you in my fucking head? His eyes protruded, a web of veins pulsing from his forehead. I knew it had to be bad. Of all the guys, this was Hillary's measured, policy-minded one. I never knew this guy to confront reporters over much of anything except maybe to point out Hillary's role in the Iran nuclear deal. When Iran was serious about coming to the table, we had laid the table. By this point, it was Secretary Kerry's turn. But in the lobby of the Manchester Radisson, 3 days after the Iowa caucuses, he saw me, stopped his deliberate stride, turned around, and unleashed. By 1 p.m. the day after the caucuses, during the We're Here and We're Awake rally in Nashua, the AP had called Iowa for Hillary. She defeated Bernie by 0.25 percentage point, including, we later learned, winning 6 coin tosses in tied precincts. The future of our democracy dangling in the air as Iowa's state coin descended in the Weeks Middle School gymnasium, home of the Wildcats. Tails, Hillary gets the extra delegate. Hillary couldn't stand when reporters put her on the couch, a common practice given the opaque reality of her own self. Even Hillary's closest girlfriends admitted she was impenetrable. So what the hell did some reporter who was in high school during the Clinton administration know? Aside from the psychological blow stuff, I heard that Hillary was livid about the tone of my Iowa story. She went on a tear to the guys that only she, Hillary Clinton, she'd recently dropped the Rodham, sufferer of double standards, endurer of an impossibly high bar, number one most put upon politician in modern history, could win Iowa and still have the Times say the caucuses dealt a psychological blow to her campaign. I couldn't argue with that. But she was also Hillary fucking Clinton, and she essentially tied with a 74-year-old Brooklyn-born Jew whose primary legislative achievements in a quarter century in Congress were the renaming of 2 post offices in Vermont. Now we were in New Hampshire, where polls had Bernie up by as much as 30 points. Brooklyn stopped spending money in the state, and aides urged Hillary to skip it and focus on Nevada and South Carolina. But New Hampshire had done a lot for the Clintons, and she would need its 4 electoral college votes in the general. Hillary became sullen. There is an image of her with her head on Bill's shoulder. He has his reading glasses on, and she is limp and resting on him like she doesn't want to do it anymore. She was pouty and aggrieved, but not surprised that the media hadn't given her her rightful due. Brooklyn summed up her sentiment as, "I'm the first woman to ever win the Iowa caucuses, and it's like it never happened." I don't regret the story or its tone. At the time, the caucuses looked like a tie, and the campaign contemplated an upheaval. But I regretted the confrontation. I regretted that a couple of days into New Hampshire, things had become so toxic with the guys that they hardly spoke to me, except for the most mature of the bunch, policy guy, the one who was also personally closest to Hillary, cornering me in a hotel lobby to spontaneously combust. I tried not to meet policy guy's eyes. To my left, there was a wall of windows, and I envisioned making my escape, bursting through, leaving an outline of my body in the glass like a cartoon cutout. I stammered, I'd be happy to discuss your concerns with the story, and, if you want to talk to my editor... The lobby smelled of burnt breakfast sausages from the buffet that a couple of busboys were now packing up. The invite to the Bloomberg Politics Breakfast Briefing with Robbie Mook read, "This event is a seated buffet breakfast, so please arrive by 7:15 to ensure that we can start on time." I got there at 7:45 a.m., dreading seeing Robbie, whom I'd just eviscerated to millions of unique viewers. As usual, I tried to comfort myself with the free food, piling 2 halves of Eggs Benedict, topped with sauce as bright and yellow as antifreeze, onto my plate. I took an empty seat between Margaret Talev of Bloomberg and MSNBC's Casey Hunt at the end of the rectangular table ensconced in a black tablecloth and a white silk runner down the middle. The Boston Globe's Annie Linsky, The Washington Post's Ruth Marcus, and USA Today's Susan Page sat nearby. The men, Bloomberg's Al Hunt, John Heilman, CNBC's John Harwood, and others were clustered together in the middle of the table as Robbie and hired gun guy held court, giving the room a gender divide as pronounced as at my third cousin's Chabad Lubavitch wedding ceremony. My question is about the younger voters who seem to be in full-on rebellion against Hillary Clinton. "I've never seen a 70-point margin in a demographic in a primary like this," one reporter started to ask. Robbie interrupted. "Well, first of all, that's based on an Iowa entrance poll." And days later, Bernie would win the New Hampshire primary by a 69-point margin among voters under 30. This wasn't an Iowa entrance poll problem. Robbie, with his boyish good looks and buoyant, affable manner, had become somewhat of a sex symbol among a very specific subset of Washington power gays. He didn't flaunt his position as the first gay campaign manager of a major presidential candidate, but Robbie had a remarkable ability to move his lips without saying anything. We'd ask him questions and words like, "She's going to fight for every single vote," and "Is the next president going to keep us pushing forward in the future, or are we